This is the AI Health Podcast, where we explore the ways in which AI will transform healthcare, biotech, and medicine through conversations with entrepreneurs, investors, and scientists.
Hey, I'm your co-host, Pranav Rajpurkar.
And I'm Adrielle Saporta.
And you're listening to the AI Health Podcast.
Today, we'll be speaking with Professor Sherry Rose of Stanford University. She's an associate professor in the Center for Health Policy and Center for Primary Care and Outcomes Research, as well as co-director of the Health Policy Data Science Lab. A lot of her work tackles how modern machine learning approaches can be used to craft better health policy, for example, for more effective risk adjustment, comparative effectiveness research, and health program evaluation.
Yeah, that should be fun. In our conversation, we'll talk about what this work looks like in these different domains and why these different problems need different mathematical tools. We'll talk about prediction problems in which a researcher has some number of variables and is tasked with making a prediction, say the likelihood of needing a surgery in the upcoming year. And we'll talk about causal inference problems in which a researcher has observational data and must determine, for example, whether some intervention caused some result or whether it was merely correlated with it.
We'll be covering a number of different ways in which this kind of work can help craft policy. So for example, we'll talk about Professor Rose's work, which showed that policies that prohibit insurers from discriminating based on gender identity may lead to decreases in suicidality among gender minority enrollees. But before we speak with Professor Rose, let's first go into more detail on one story, which is risk adjustment. It's a really important and illuminating example for how these statistical techniques can make their way into policy.
Yeah, that's perfect. Let's start with what risk adjustment is.
Okay, so let's say that we want to compare two providers to see which is providing better or more efficient care, and one provider cares for older patients on average. In order to make a direct comparison between the two, we need to adjust for the increased risk associated with these older patients. And so the heart of risk adjustment is how exactly you go about creating a formula which takes that into account.
Great. So how and where are these kind of processes currently being used?
Let's start with our old friend, Medicare Advantage. Medicare Advantage is a program which is parallel to traditional fee-for-service Medicare, in which private insurers are given some amount of money by the government to care for a patient. Now, the idea is that the government gives these private insurers around as much as patients would be expected to cost the government. The private insurers then are incentivized to care for the patients more efficiently and then keep the profit. Now, of course, different patients will be expected to cost more or less based on where they live, how old they are, what pre-existing conditions they may have, among a few other factors. And so the government has a risk adjustment formula, which it uses to make this estimation. So for example, if a Medicare Advantage organization enrolls a patient with cancer, the government will pay that Medicare Advantage organization more in order to take care of that patient.
Got it. And it seems like this risk adjustment would be needed for a lot of the risk-sharing advanced payment models we discussed when talking about value-based care. Anytime an insurer pays a provider some kind of capitation payment to take care of a patient, they need to be able to estimate how much this particular patient is likely to cost. What other context does this crop up in?
Another important one is in the Affordable Care Act. So the ACA allows private insurers to adjust premiums based on only a few factors like county, age, and tobacco use. But they're prohibited from charging more for patients with pre-existing conditions. And there are limits on how much more they can charge based on even age. While private insurers are not allowed to deny coverage, there are a couple of clever things that they could try to do to attract healthier and therefore cheaper clientele. So for example, they could target their advertising, they could cater to what supplemental benefits they provide, they can design provider networks in a way that would deter patients with certain conditions.
Right. I see some of the difficulty in trying to use for-profit companies to operate for the public good here. How exactly does risk adjustment play in?
Well, the solution designed by the Affordable Care Act is that all insurers that offer individual or small group plans must also participate in the risk adjustment plan. Basically, insurers that care for healthier patients must pay insurers that care for less healthy patients. The goal is to remove the incentive to target healthier patients. It's a redistribution that's budget neutral, so the government doesn't spend or make any money on it.
Gotcha. That makes sense. Can we get into some more detail on how this risk adjustment calculation is actually done?
Yeah. So to start, insurers submit claims and enrollment data for a given year. CMS software then determines the relevant demographic and diagnosis information for each enrollee.
What does CMS have to do with this here?
So the Affordable Care Act tasked the CMS with implementing this risk adjustment program. Overall, it's very similar to the risk adjustment process used for Medicare Advantage. You know, hopefully our listeners remember the 70,000 ICD diagnosis codes that we talked about last episode.
Unforgettable.
Those provide, providers have to document those codes in order to be properly reimbursed by insurers. A subset of those codes, around 10,000, are then mapped to about 100 distinct diagnoses that have been found to have the most significant impact on a patient's predicted cost in the upcoming year.
And what if a patient has multiple important diagnoses?
Yeah, so patients ultimately only carry codes that are the most severe for a given category. So for example, diabetes with complications overrides diabetes without complications.
Mm.
And if a patient has multiple unrelated diagnoses, they're added together.
Cool. Are there other factors, though, that are determining an individual patient's risk?
Yeah. So in the Affordable Care Act risk readjustment plan, there are three distinct models for adults, children, and infants. In the adult model, which we'll focus on for right now, there are some additional two-way interaction terms that account for diseases which have a combined effect that is more severe than each individual effect added together. So for example, a 50-year-old man with diabetes and congestive heart failure will have four separate risk factors.
Can I guess what those are?
Go for it.
So one for the diabetes, one for the congestive heart failure.
You got it.
And I can think of one for the demographic. What's the one I'm missing?
It's the extra one for an interaction between those three other factors.
Got it. Cool. So it seems like there's quite a lot of clinical background behind the features used for the model. Is there anything else that is used in addition to the diagnostic factors?
So the adult model also has a risk factor just associated with the demographic category, age and sex, and then an extra risk factor added if you're only part of the plan for a partial year. And then everything is multiplied by a cost sharing factor that accounts for the fact that enrollees in plans with lower deductibles and coinsurance are likely to use more services than enrollees who have to pay more out of pocket.
So when everything is combined, the total overall risk, called the risk adjustment factor here, represents how much more risk this patient carries compared to an average member of the population.
You got it.
We're not going to get too much into what exact modeling is done to get at these actual numbers for these risk factors, but I am curious what data is used.
Yeah, so for the Affordable Care Act, modeling was originally based on a privately owned data set that was deemed the best available at the time, even though it only contained data from employer-sponsored programs. 2021 is actually the first year that this data set has now been fully replaced by the data that the government collects each year as part of its program.
Okay. So just to wrap things up, I'm guessing there is some way to add up all of the enrollees for a plan, determine how much they're likely to cost, and compare it to how much a plan is likely to receive from premium revenue?
Exactly. And both sides of the equation are interesting and complicated. But yes, in the end, if a plan has expected cost that exceeds expected revenue, they will receive a payment transfer from the risk adjustment program and vice versa if not.
So now zooming out a bit, how does this compare with the risk adjustment program that we talked about for Medicare Advantage?
Yeah, really good question. And this will also help us see some of the ways in which the particular context has to be taken into account for some of the modeling and how it's affected by politics. One big difference is that risk adjustment for Medicare Advantage is not budget neutral. In fact, the government ends up paying an average of 4% more to Medicare Advantage organizations than they would if that patient were covered under traditional fee-for-service Medicare.
And what's driving this discrepancy?
There are a few factors, and some are due to issues with how CMS establishes payment benchmarks, but one of the big ones is coding intensity. Since Medicare Advantage organizations receive more money for caring for patients with more severe diagnoses, they have an incentive to make sure they're very thorough about coding their enrollees. For example, they'll hire companies to do what's called chart review, which is retrospectively seeing if a profitable diagnosis coding was missed. Insurers implementing traditional Medicare don't have a similar incentive. So the Medicare Advantage population is likely to look sicker, even if it's not. The Medicare Payment Advisory Commission reported that in 2019, Medicare overpaid by $9 billion due to Medicare Advantage enrollees being coded with an average risk factor of 9% more.
Okay, I see how this is an interesting case in which modeling can be rather difficult, since the coding intensity is going to vary across populations and over time. Is there anything the government can do to account for this?
So the Affordable Care Act created a schedule of minimum adjustments that the risk adjustment formula must incorporate to account for the predictable increase in coding intensity over time. So in other words, the risk factors are automatically decreased by a little more each year to account for new coding. But that minimum is set at about 6%, which is well under the 9% that has been empirically observed.
This sounds like a great segue to a conversation with Professor Sherry Rose, who has a lot of experience not only with innovating on statistical models, but pushing new insights into becoming actual policy. Thank you for being with us on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start by asking you about some of the work that you do on causal inference. Could you maybe describe the goal of causal inferences?
Absolutely. So with causal inference, we're interested in understanding the impact of a treatment, an exposure, or an intervention on an outcome or outcomes. A lot of the work that is done in machine learning is focused on predicting outcomes rather than trying to understand these impacts or these effects.
In a lot of settings, when we make predictions with machine learning, we talk about needing to understand why a prediction is being made. You know, how is the system working? Mm-hmm. And on this particular patient, why was the prediction made that this patient would have a heart condition in five mm-hmm. years? Mm-hmm.
So this might be getting at a lot of the research that's been done in so-called explainable or interpretable machine learning, where with explainable machine learning, we have really complex systems that you might be able to explain some of what's going on under the hood. But with interpretable machine learning, we can actually look at that prediction function and be able to identify these specific factors in a much more straightforward way. And so there's a lot of people that preference interpretable machine learning for these reasons, because then we can say, these are the specific predictors that led to this type of prediction. And what is going to be preferable will really depend on the context in the healthcare system.
And am I right that a prediction question is different from a causal inference question?
In general, yes, that is true. There's a lot of feedback between the two, because even with a prediction question, there's a causal system underneath that that leads to us having certain types of outcomes. So a lot of my research in studying how we pay physicians and clinicians, that is a straightforward prediction question in many cases, but understanding why those incentives exist in the healthcare system, those are causal questions. And, you know, what happens if we change this type of payment model? What's that going to do to how we pay? That brings in this more complex causal feedback.
Can you maybe give us an example of a problem and how it might be framed if you were talking about it from a prediction standpoint and how you might talk about it from a causal inference standpoint?
Absolutely. So one of the things that we do in plan payment risk adjustment, which is an area that I study where we're trying to make sure that health plans are paid based on giving efficient care to patients rather than them trying to avoid high cost or sicker patients. But what we know happens is that there are gaps in the way that risk adjustment does this. So that's a prediction question. We have formulas where there are a lot of different flags for different health conditions that individuals may have. We also, in some risk adjustment systems, have categorical variables that are documented sex and age bins, but we use only that information in order to predict their spending for the year. And so that's a pure prediction question. Here are the health conditions that you were noted as having for this particular year. And then what's your spending going to be in the next year? But what we know is that if we were going to think about health spending as a causal question, in that same year, we might know that there's been a change to how doctors are being paid. So maybe there's something called bundled payments for different types of procedures. This could be a joint replacement or a pregnancy. And if that type of a change happened in that same year, we might ask a causal question, what was the impact of bundled payment on spending? And so then that's not a prediction question. It's trying to understand this change to how payments were made, how we're going to assign payments in that year.
And when you're making these types of causal relationships or determining these causal relationships, do you have to come in with an assumption or understanding of what that relationship looks like already? Or are you trying to sort of piece out that relationship based on the data that you're given?
That's a great question. So you might be interested in either, but a lot of the research, especially in the areas that I work in health policy, we need to know something about the system that generated that data. We need to know what are the variables that are related with both that intervention and the outcome. Have we measured them? Have we measured them with any accuracy? We do have to have some knowledge and then make some additional, many untestable assumptions about the relationships between the things that we've measured and not measured.
I would love to maybe talk very quickly about the plan payment risk adjustment work that you've done. You mentioned these formulas that are generally used. Are those formulas that are used by payers normally, or who are those formulas generally used by?
So a lot of the risk adjustment systems, both in the US and in other countries, these formulas are defined by either the federal government or state government, like in Massachusetts, when they were setting the formulas for the health insurance marketplaces created by the Affordable Care Act. And so the payers aren't setting these formulas, but they are aware of them. And so they know which health conditions are included in the formulas. So they have an incentive to make sure that individuals with those health conditions have those codes. And so this leads to a lot of, when we talk about, you know, prediction questions and causal inference questions, over time, this becomes a causal inference question, because if we were to change the formula and they were to realize, oh, now additional codes for this health condition are included in the formula, well, that's going to cause them to have an incentive to make sure individuals are coded for that condition when they have that condition. It's this issue called upcoding. And there's both legal and illegal forms of upcoding, or charge captures as they're called, where they may, for certain conditions, you know, send a healthcare professional to someone's home to make sure that they get coded for their illness, because you have to have an in-person visit in order to be coded for a condition. You know, for example, somebody couldn't get coded as having diabetes from a lab test. They have to have met with a clinician in order to have a code for diabetes. And we know that something like diabetes is a more expensive health condition. And if those codes are included in the formula, they're going to be incentivized to make sure that you have codes for those conditions. And we do know that diabetes in particular is a health condition that is fairly persistently coded over time, both because people need a lot of care or have regular visits related to diabetes, but also because of these incentives that come down from the risk adjustment formulas.
Got it. So you recently published a study that showed that in states that have adopted gender minority non-discrimination rules for private health insurance policies, that the rate of suicide attempts and suicide ideation drops pretty significantly. So maybe like, what are the different types of policy changes that one can implement? Because in my mind, I'm thinking that these formulas are an example of the types of ways that you can incentivize maybe proper work by the insurance companies.
Yeah, I'd say risk adjustment is a specific area that we can make changes in order to try and see change in the way that payment happens. But there's a lot of things that happen outside risk adjustment formulas, in the ways that providers may be required to cover certain types of conditions or provide so-called parity. So we have mental health parity laws, for example. the study on individuals who are gender minorities, who are transgender, gender diverse, we were trying to understand the impact of non-discrimination policies. And so what happens when we have these non-discrimination policies related to healthcare coverage? And that's where we did see these drops in suicidality. It was a really important finding for a lot of reasons, because this hadn't been studied before. But shortly after we published this paper, we saw a number of states trying to take up discrimination policies related to transgender and gender diverse individuals and not having their gender affirming care covered. And so it became work that became very policy relevant and, you know, was used as examples in, you know, different news articles and pieces in support of making sure that these policies that are discriminatory are not passed or struck down.
Both on the risk adjustment work, but also on the example of just general health policy work that you're doing, who is your audience for papers when you're writing it? Is your hope that it gets picked up by the press so that policymakers will eventually look at it? Is the hope that insurance companies end up reading it and try to adjust their own incentive structures accordingly?
It depends on where the research is at. So a lot of the research that I've done in planned payment risk adjustment is building towards making policy recommendations. So in that case, the research is for other researchers for us to all build upon it. But my goal is always to get to something that can be a policy recommendation. So for example, I published research about building fair machine learning algorithms for planned payment risk adjustment. And I have a number of papers on that topic, but I was very careful to note that we wouldn't yet understand how using these formulas would impact the planned payment risk adjustment system, that we needed to do more research. And I had a paper that came out recently where we brought a lot of these innovations together and were able to demonstrate some of the potential side effects, and that there were mostly, we weren't seeing negative side effects. And so that was promising. And so once we're at that stage where we feel like we're able to start making some policy recommendations or working with policymakers, that is my audience. It's, I want people on the Hill to see it. I want to sometimes publish my papers in journals that they read. And so there are certain journals that only academics read. There's certain journals that people in DC are going to read. And I've had success in strategically trying to publish my papers in different venues. So preprints and white papers and working papers are also really useful in this context. I know that talking about preprinting is very popular in other fields, including computational biology, where they've done a lot of leading work in having a lot of aspects of open science. But it's really useful in policymaking to start having those conversations while it's going through the peer review process. And so this paper that was recently published is one example of that. We were able to share it, and it was starting to get noticed by policymakers because it was available as a working paper before it actually was published. So I don't necessarily target my work towards the media in general. Sometimes I think for different types of research that can be useful. But for a lot of the things I do, targeting policymakers is going to be more effective.
We're talking about policy and the impact it might have on health outcomes. How do you assess whether it is the policy that you implemented that changes the outcomes or completely something else?
That's a great question. And this is where we have to do really careful study design and analysis in order to try and rule out some other cause that would lead to the changes that we're seeing. And this is where I've worked on different methodologies in causal inference, including some methodology called targeted maximum likelihood, which brings machine learning and different types of advances in semi-parametric statistical theory together in order to have the best chance at identifying the actual causal effect that we're interested in, rather than somehow capturing all these nuisance effects that we wouldn't really want to study. But it's a very valid question. And when we're interrogating the literature, especially when we're worried that maybe a study wasn't particularly rigorous, it's always a great question to ask, because claiming causal inference is a very strong claim.
Could you give an example of where you might use one of those methods? You mentioned targeted maximum likelihood as one of those methods, and how it helps us establish a causal relationship.
Absolutely. In a study that I led a couple of years ago, we were interested in understanding the comparative effectiveness of a number of different cardiac stents And that was an example where we had measured many, many different types of variables. We had observational data, so it wasn't randomized. People were not randomized to receive these different types of stents. And so we needed to adjust for a lot of so-called confounding factors, these variables that were would be related to the fact that somebody received a particular type of stent and their ultimate mortality outcome. And so what we found in this study was that developing these methodologies to handle some additional complications in healthcare, which we know we have clustered observations in hospitals, and clustering is something that's often ignored in machine learning. We had multiple unordered treatments, so there was no ranking system for these different types of stents. They were all just separate stents. And what we found was that it was really the combination of using the machine learning and something that's called double robust estimation. So estimating both the treatment mechanism and the outcome regression. So estimating that function that would assign someone to a particular stent, and also estimating that function that would predict the outcome using both of those pieces with machine learning was really what helped us isolate the fact that there were heterogeneous effects across these stents. And in all the previous work examining this, they had lumped all these stents together. And so those heterogeneous effects were something that we previously hadn't seen. And we did compare this, you know, double robust machine learning targeted maximum likelihood estimation. We compared these methodologies to other techniques that exist, much more simple techniques, slightly more complicated techniques. And we found that it was only the targeted maximum likelihood that was able to identify these heterogeneous effects. And we were able to reproduce the same finding in simulated data, because you might say, okay, well, how do you know that these effects are real? Because we don't know the underlying truth. And we were able to recreate the same setting where only this particular estimator was able to find these effects. And so that's where, when we do have these questions about, well, is this particular policy, you know, really leading to this outcome, or do we really understand what the effect of this particular treatment is? It's not something else in that patient's history. These causal inference estimators that incorporate machine learning can be incredibly effective.
Traditionally, especially within the regime of medicine, we've thought of randomized control trials as being the sort of standard to be able to tell whether or not a treatment works. And it sounds from what you just said that there is hope for just data that's out in the real world that we observe, what we call observational data, to enable us to also derive some causal insights. I want to ask whether there are limitations of randomized control trials that you see as being strengths of observational studies.
Absolutely. So I think I'll lead off by saying we should be skeptical of all data sources. So observational data, a lot of the data that is available is not well suited to studying causal effects or even prediction questions. And so we should be really thoughtful about the data that we use. And that's also true of randomized trial data as well. That said, we should definitely not be dismissive of observational data as a data source to study causal inference when we are really careful and thoughtful about the variables that have been collected, what we think the underlying causal model is, because we do know there are a lot of limitations with randomized trials. In particular, we know that many or most randomized trials have difficulty generalizing to the population that we actually want to make inference about. The individuals who are in the trial generally do not represent the people who would ultimately take the drug or have that intervention. And so that can make some pretty problematic conclusions when, in particular, certain types of study designs and particular studies do not have individuals from different racial and ethnic backgrounds, different socioeconomic status. And so that's not going to generalize to other populations. And this has been incredibly problematic, especially when studying health conditions that disproportionately impact racial and ethnic minorities, when they're underrepresented in the trials relative to the disease burden in those populations. And so how can we say that these treatments or these interventions will work in populations where they haven't been studied? And this is an issue that is just rampant when we think about the generalizability of randomized trials.
You mentioned these sort of nuisance variables or these confounding variables. What happens if you are not aware of a potential confounding variable? Because I imagine that's a common problem.
That's a great question, and it is a common problem. And it's one of the reasons why I'm such a huge proponent of people who are in technical fields, be it statistics, my PhD is in biostatistics, computer science, machine learning. If you're in a technical field and you're doing health related work, it's incredibly important to be embedded in the areas that you're studying and to really invest the time to understand the disease process, the policy implications, whatever the topic is that you're working on, because otherwise you're not going to be able to correctly formulate causal questions in health. And so working in diverse teams is important, but becoming yourself dual trained, you know, on the job, if you're not already, is incredibly important, because otherwise it's really difficult to claim that you've actually thought about all of the relevant confounders. And it's something we see a lot in the research, that there's a lot of people who are either very technically trained and are throwing some sort of tool at some data, and they just want to know, okay, what are the covariates? What's the outcome and what's the treatment? And they want to throw their tool at it. And then on the other side, we have a lot of people who are very interested in using these tools and have a lot of deep knowledge about the disease process or the policy environment, but don't know how to correctly and adequately use the tools. And we have very few people who are doing both. And we need more people in the middle who care about both, because that's where the best science is going to be.
You spoke a little bit about the issue of having samples that are unrepresentative of the target population, either as part of the randomized control trial or in observational data. Could you give an example of where this might have hurt the medical field? And I know there are many examples here, which one can draw from.
Absolutely. So one of the studies that I was alluding to earlier was related to this report published by ProPublica, where they were actually studying cancer clinical trials. And they demonstrated that even for different types of cancers, where Black and African American patients disproportionately have those cancers, they were underrepresented in the trial. So one trial only had 2% of enrolled patients who were Black or African American, but the proportion of people with that cancer, 20% of them are Black or African American. And so when we have trials that are predominantly white or do not represent the populations who experience those disease burdens, you know, how can we draw inference about how those cancer drugs will work in these populations? And how can we also build the trust required that these types of treatments will work? And there's a lot of, you know, historical issues related to this along many different axes, including gender and, like we talked about before, also socioeconomic status. When we think about treatments that are labor intensive, that maybe require you to check some measurement multiple times a day or require a lot of equipment, you know, is that actually going to be feasible in practice for individuals who have fewer resources?
How do you think about the applicability of any sort of insights from data in terms of their applicability to unique individuals? When we think of individuals, a bunch of characteristics, there's their age, there's socioeconomic status, there's existing health conditions. Do you think that it's possible for us to be able to say, this is a person and here's all that we know about them, here's how a treatment is going to work for them, or here's how well the data that supports us giving this particular medicine would apply to this person?
This is an interesting question. A lot of the research that is done is at the so-called population level, or sometimes the sample level, when they're not able to generalize to the population level. But there is a lot of work in so-called precision medicine and other names that are used that really is aimed at targeting the individual. I think we should be really careful when we look at this work, because much of it is not actually personalized or individual level predictions or individual level effects, but rather it's dicing it up by different covariates. So it's not necessarily an individual level effect, but it's the effect for a person who is of this particular documented sex, age category, you know, health condition one, health condition two. And so I think some of this work has been overhyped. There is, I think, potential there, but I think we also need to be fairly critical. And anytime we would make a genuinely individual level inference or prediction, there's often going to be a lot of error around that. And so it's really helpful when we think about, okay, what would we use this individual level effect or prediction for? And if it's for communicating it directly to a patient, how would we communicate the error around that? How would we communicate the uncertainty and the noise?
Are there ways to be able to estimate the uncertainty or the noise for the prediction on any individual?
The same logic around how we calculate uncertainty for samples and at the population level, there are techniques to do that at the individual level. But when you think about how we calculate uncertainty, when you get down to smaller and smaller units, you're going to often have larger and larger amounts of uncertainty. So that was really what I was trying to call attention to, is that an individual level prediction or an individual level effect is often going to have much more uncertainty because your unit is much smaller.
I want to ask a question related to that, and you've written about this in your research. What does it mean for an algorithm to be fair?
Oh, that's a great question, and it's a tough question. There isn't a single definition of what fair means. There are many definitions of fairness, and they are typically context specific. And so while a lot of my research has focused on different types of algorithmic considerations and also data-related considerations, some other things to think about in fairness are, you know, who decides the research question, who's in the target population? We've been talking about this. Again, what do the data reflect? We know a lot of our data reflect structural racism and issues of access to care in rural communities and low SES populations. But a lot of the focus has been on how algorithms will be assessed. And there are many different metrics and definitions for what supposedly makes a fair algorithm. But I think you could get many people in a room and you would not get consensus on one definition of fairness. And validly so, I think just for the things that I work on, there's no one definition of fairness. So when we go back to the plan payment risk adjustment example, we know that there are many groups that are marginalized in the healthcare system. And some of these groups are individuals who have specific types of health conditions where their health condition and the way that the risk adjustment formulas currently operate leads them to have costs that are underpredicted, which means that the insurers are going to be undercompensated. And so we know there are many such groups. Which groups should we be prioritizing for fairness? Because we're aware of some. There are others that we are not aware of. And some of my recent work has focused on trying to understand complex intersectional groups and, you know, which groups are currently not understood to be marginalized, but are in the system. And I could talk about this for a long time, but basically it would just come back to the same answer, is that no single definition of fairness.
Right. Just to maybe illustrate the complexity here, I'd like to maybe throw out an example and a proposed solution, and then maybe you can share why it wouldn't be the full solution. So let's say I have an algorithm that claims to work on people. I divide people into males and females, and I ask, does the algorithm perform equally well on the two? And then I say it performs equally well on the two, therefore the algorithm is fair. Where does this logic break down?
Well, I'd say the first thing would be in your binary classification of gender. So we know that dividing the data up into a binary classification is not going to capture the complexity of gender. So even before we get into the algorithm itself, I would have some data-related questions for you. How did you measure your documented sex or gender category? Is that self-report? We know that there's a lot of missing, miss, and error in data related to features of identification. And I would ask you for clarification on your procedure. Did you build a single algorithm on all of the data? Or did you separate the data and fit separate algorithms?
I'm curious how you think about holding people accountable just to creating fair algorithms using fair data. You know, there are a lot of people who aren't necessarily working on, you know, quote, fair ML, but should still care about making sure that the work that they're doing is fair. And I guess, how do we all as a community hold each other accountable, but also how does each one of us individually hold ourselves accountable?
I think those are great questions, and there's a lot of different things I think we can do. So one of the things that I would love for us to do as a machine learning community and an AI community is to have a set of standards. Right now, there's a number of different standards in the literature for building certain different types of algorithms. Most of these sets of standards do not involve any level of fairness criteria. So there's no requirement that you have studied for subgroup fairness in any way. There's no requirement that you've considered any kind of ethical considerations. And so one of the things that I worked on with a number of colleagues in this paper was led by a PhD student at MIT, Irene Chen, was developing this pipeline for ethical algorithms in machine learning, specifically for healthcare, starting from problem selection all the way through to post-deployment. And so the more that we can get buy-in on these types of issues, again, whether you think you're working on a fairness problem or an ethics problem, everything in the healthcare system, you know, is going to impact real people. And so I completely agree with you that even though you might not think you're working on these problems, you are, because we have to think about the ethical considerations. And one of the things that I run into a lot with people, you know, I'm a statistician. I also work with economists, computer scientists, and a lot of people feel like these types of considerations don't apply to them because they're only working on methods or they're only working on theoretical considerations. And this is where I've pushed back, and sometimes in commentary, sometimes in, you know, when I give talks, to say that if you're working on methods, you still have an obligation to think about how people are going to use these tools. You can't hide behind the idea that, oh, this is irrelevant to me because I'm just working on methods. And you do have to have a responsibility. You know, we talk about open science and preprints and code sharing, but if you're going to develop a method and release code for it, you have to think about how people are going to use it. And there's different levels to that, but I think it's a conversation we need to be having more. I think the reality is that a lot of times change doesn't happen in communities until it's dictated either by journal requirements, funders, and other external groups. And so I think that's also something that needs to happen. If you can't publish your papers in machine learning without, you know, following some kind of pipeline for ethical machine learning or following a checklist that includes these things, then people will do it. And so I do think that that's where we need to get to. And we need to go beyond that, but that's going to be, I think, a part of it.
This is an important call to action. Beyond academia, when you think of industry efforts, do you feel like a similar top-down, this has got to be a part of the FDA submission or something along those lines in terms of to the insurers that this is an algorithm and here we have demonstrated it to be a fair algorithm and we've talked about ethical considerations, therefore we should be considered for reimbursement. Do you see a future for that?
I believe there's definitely a role for organizations like the FDA, where they can be one of those external entities that requires and enforces certain types of requirements. I think it's less likely that we can rely on insurers or health tech companies to be the leaders in this space, because we've seen this recently with Timnit Gebru, who was fired at Google as one of the co-leads of the ethical AI team there, and just the fallout from all of that, where when you are being critical of your own processes or technology, how is that going to be well received within the company? And so I think that it's unlikely that we can rely on companies to self-regulate. Even when they have well-intentioned and incredible people working there, they often will end up not working there at some point if they are going to potentially impact the bottom line of that company.
Thank you so much for doing this. This was fabulous.
Yeah, of course.
And that's all, folks. A big thank you to Professor Sherry Rose for talking to us today. And thank you for listening. We're your host, Pranav and Atriel, and until next time, stay safe and stay healthy.
The AI Health Podcast is produced and edited by Oishi Banerjee and Mark Robbins. Music by Ethan A.G. If you like what you just heard, let a friend know. Subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Spotify or connect with us on Twitter at AI Health Podcast.